Welcome to another Crime Cast by Revamp. Revamp is a 501c3 nonprofit based out of Fort Smith, Arkansas. We take cold cases, missing person cases that have not been thoroughly investigated or have been investigated in a long time, and we take a new look at it. We've been very successful in the past, and so today we're going to talk about one of our favorite subjects around our team, and that is the subject of Charles Ray Vines. I have Greg Murray, who is our technical director, and I have Tom Honeycutt, who is our team coordinator, here with me today, and we're going to talk about Charles Ray Vines, the River Valley Killer.
Yeah, he's one interesting individual. I'm just going to ask the question, when did we first get him on the radar?
I've had him on the radar for a long time, but he wasn't really on the radar until 1999 when he was arrested for attacking a young child. And I say child, she was only 16 years old. And one of the detectives realized that on the way to the crime scene, he passed a homicide scene that had been unsolved.
And that was in 99, okay.
Mm-hmm. So Tom and I have done a lot of more research on him, and we've come up with a lot of new information, information that probably was not obtained by any other agency or group, and it's been very interesting.
Let's talk about, before we get into all the stuff that's Charles Ray Vines, let's talk about his history. What did he do when he was growing up, kind of the area where he lived in and all that. So what exactly did Charles Ray do for a living?
Well, when he was a child, his father was involved heavily with funeral preparations, and it have been told that he was actually a deputy coroner. I've been told by many people that he was deputy coroner. He also was very involved in a funeral home in Greenwood, Arkansas. When he grew up, there's not a lot known about his childhood. He grew up in Greenwood. He went to school in Greenwood. He has a lot of schoolmates that knew of him. Tom has the psychiatric evaluation on him, and I think that that would be a good place to start.
Okay.
Because it gives a lot of his history.
Okay. And now, Greenwood is just south of Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Fort Smith.
So
mm-hmm.
That's where he grew up, and then he eventually moved to Fort Smith. And so we're going to do the
He moved around a lot.
He
moved around a lot. He didn't like to be on the radar really so much. But when Tom reads the psychiatric evaluation, I think it'll give you a good history of his adolescence.
Okay, Tom, take it away.
Here's a little bit of background. Now, psychiatric evaluation often is conducted in a criminal case to determine if the defendant has the ability to understand the charges against him or her. And it's generally done before they get close to any kind of trial date or plea date. In the case of Charles Ray Vine, he was evaluated in around August of 2000 as part of the Crawford County case, two Crawford County cases. And this was done through the Arkansas Department of Health Services by a supervising forensic psychologist. And the report was issued to the judge in Crawford County as part of the case. And it's actually public record. When I went back and started doing some more research to try and fill in some of the gaps in Charles Ray Vines'
What case was this involving?
Well, it was both of the cases in Crawford County.
It would have been one of the homicide cases and then the attack, brutal attack and rape of the young child.
Okay, so 1999.
They were consolidated for the purposes of this evaluation. So this involved a direct interview with Charles Ray Vines, a clinical interview as it's described in this, on August the 1st of 2000. And psychosocial history was completed by a staff social worker, and then the review of the legal information obtained from the Crawford County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, and review of detention response forms, you know, some of the paperwork. But anyway, it goes through the official version of the alleged offenses, and also goes into Charles Ray Vines' view of them and relevant history. So really, since we can't post this document, I think it'd be useful to read at least from a big portion of it, so I'm going to do that. The official version of the alleged offenses: Mr. Vines has officially been charged with rape, attempted murder in the first degree, and criminal use of a prohibited weapon with regard to an incident which has said to have occurred on March 28, 2000. In addition, he is also facing charges of capital murder, rape, and residential burglary with regard to an incident which has said to have occurred on August 9, 1995. According to information obtained from the prosecuting attorney's office, the victim in the March 2000 charges is redacted information. According to information provided to the police by Mr. Williams, Mr. Vines allegedly came to the residence and asked if her parents were home. They talked briefly, and then Mr. Vines asked to use the restroom. The victim stated that she was sitting on the couch when Mr. Vines entered the room and started to sit on the couch next to her. She reportedly told him to sit on the recliner, but he sat on the couch anyway. He subsequently grabbed her, threatened her with a knife, and told her to take her pants off. He reportedly then proceeded to rape her. The victim stated that this lasted 3 to 4 minutes, and she was then able to struggle away from him. However, he subsequently came after her again, and she started fighting and kicking him in an attempt to avoid being raped a second time. He then reportedly beat her, stabbed her, and attempted to strangle her and cut her throat with a knife. While he was attempting to strangle her, mother and stepfather apparently returned home, pulled Mr. Vines off of her, and subsequently subdued him. The file we obtained from the prosecuting attorney's office did not contain any details regarding the 1995 charges. However, it was noted that the charges involved the rape and murder of a female. Apparently, blood was withdrawn from Mr. Vines following his arrest on the above charges. It was sent to the Arkansas Crime Lab for testing and was subsequently compared to evidence taken from the scene of her murder. Testing done at the Arkansas Crime Lab concluded that there was a match of the DNA profile found on her body and the DNA profile obtained from Mr. Vines. This resulted in Mr. Vines being charged with capital murder, rape, and residential burglary in the murder case. Now, I'm going to cover another section here referred to as relevant history. This is Mr. Vines' first admission to the Arkansas State Hospital, and he denies any prior history of psychiatric treatment. He did report making suicidal gestures both at the age of 17 and 20. His description of these incidents made them sound rather manipulative, and neither apparently resulted in him receiving any type of medical attention or psychiatric follow-up. Mr. Vines acknowledged a long history of alcohol and drug abuse. He reports that he began drinking at the age of 13 and relates that he drank on a daily basis up until the time of his arrest. He states that he typically drank between a fifth and a half gallon of whiskey per day and occasionally drank a 12-pack of beer along with the whiskey. He reports that he began smoking marijuana about the age of 15 and used this on a daily basis up until the time of his arrest. He reports that he began using a stimulant described as, quote-unquote, white crosses at the age of 16. He reported that he took about six of these pills a day from the age of 16 until he stopped using drugs in the summer of 1999. He reports that about 6 years ago he began using crystal methamphetamines and crank on a regular basis. He acknowledged using acid regularly between the ages of 16 and 20, but states that he has used it only a few times since then. He also admitted trying cocaine, but stated that he has only used it a couple of times. With regard to substance abuse treatment, he reports that he received substance abuse counseling while in the military and also attended 8 to 10 sessions of outpatient counseling at Harbor House when he was 17. The next part I'd like to cover here is a clinical evaluation, and this speaks to who he was at the time that he was under these charges. The report writer noted Mr. Vines presented himself as a healthy-looking, mildly obese, 37-year-old white male. He was dressed in an orange jail uniform and was noted to have a neatly groomed mustache and goatee. He was clearly well-oriented and appeared to be in good contact with reality. His thought processes and content were normal, and there was no evidence that he was experiencing hallucinations of any type. His verbalizations were logical, coherent, and thus easy to follow. He displayed no unusual or bizarre behavior at any time during the evaluation, despite claiming that he was innocent, at least regarding the 2000 charges. He did not appear to be particularly distressed about his present legal predicament.
Okay, there's a couple things that I want to circle back around to. I want to make a correction on the when I said 1999, it was, I guess, actually 2000. The 1993 case, homicide case, was in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and it was a homicide. And there had been an attack on an elderly blind woman previously to that, that they have connected to the same perpetrator that killed Juanita Wofford. Now, Charles went on to be convicted of Juanita Wofford and Ruth Henderson. He confessed because they had DNA and he knew it, but then he shut up and wouldn't talk anymore about it. So we know that he was murdering in 1993 and 1995. We believe he is the number one suspect in a 1994 case in which there was a deceased person that was found in some plastic bags right across the state line. But he was a very intelligent man because we found where he had gone to, after he got out of high school, he joined the military. He joined the Army. He was dishonorably discharged. Then he went to the University of Arkansas, which was at that time West Ark Community College. He got rewards for excellence in mathematics, physics, and chemistry.
Yeah, he was a smart guy.
Yeah, he was.
So basically, what we're doing right now for the audience is we're working our way backwards. So the 2000 case was the 16-year-old girl that originally got him caught.
And I've said this to her, and I'll say this again. She was a hero. She survived. She fought for her life. She had 11 stab wounds. Her clavicle was completely cut in two. By all rights, she should have been dead.
She
had a strong will to live.
And our thoughts and prayers go out with her daily.
You know what we would like to do with our research is understand more about him and maybe connect him to some other cases. We don't really want to dredge this up to cause more grief on any of the involved parties, families, and friends of the family who live this case really daily because of the impact on them. So, but what we've learned in many instances is that the prosecution of a case is very narrowly focused, and it doesn't necessarily broaden, except if it's looking for more, more culpable parties. And so it's just like in the case we followed very closely with Alvin Lee Myers. When you broaden your perspective, you may be able to see patterns. You may be able to see connections. You may be able to actually identify witnesses that can help you with other cases that aren't on the radar for law enforcement because they're looking to fairly narrowly focus and prosecute and get that person in prison for.
Yeah, they're focused on that singular thing that they can get him on.
It does not appear law enforcement was interested in going back into Charles Ray Vine in any capacity, even though he was available to them if he was willing to talk.
Well, let's be fair to them. What they had was a very high-profile homicides in Crawford County and in Fort Smith. They suspected they were connected, and they was putting a lot of public pressure on authorities to find out if we had a serial killer. Now, there was actually three victims that they thought were connected to the same perpetrator, and one of them, like I said, was an elderly blind woman. Now, what's interesting to me is that he often circulated in an area that was comfortable for him.
Yeah.
You know where I'm going with this,
yeah,
right?
Predatorial.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, in 1993, he attacked
And Patty's got her over here. Has got a poster board of Timeline for Charles Ray Vines. I've never seen anything like it, but that thing has got a lot of information on it.
And it will make sense to anybody but me, because I just make little short notes as I go. But he's been married several times, and we actually were able to locate a spouse that we've never heard about. And now we believe there's another spouse that from Hope, Missouri. But let's go back and talk about Charles Ray Vines' earlier career.
All right, so we're jumping from 2000. We got to 95.
But let's go back to the mid-90s. In the mid-90s, he was living and had connections to Jenny Lind, okay, to the street, Jenny Lind in Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Okay.
His first victim, Lily Jones, she was an elderly blind woman. She survived, but she could not identify him because she was legally blind. She did survive. The second victim was killed right off Jenny Lind. She was brutally attacked and then raped after she was deceased. Now, this is just speculation, but I've talked to some of his coworkers, I've talked to some of his family, I've talked to some of his friends, his acquaintances, and a lot of people in law enforcement. At the same time that all of this is happening, Melissa Witt goes missing.
Yes.
And it's just a jog over from Jenny Lind. But not only that, one thing that people don't realize about Charles Ray Vines is he was an avid pool player. He would actually carry a cue stick in a case with him to work. So that in case they stop somewhere for lunch and there happened to be a pool table, he could play pool. And so he was an avid pool player.
Yeah, there's several places in Fort Smith to go play pool at.
Combine that with another piece of information.
Right.
Another piece of information is that he had just been to that same area where her body was found just a few days before doing some repair work on a tombstone at Campbell Cemetery.
This is all speculation.
It's all speculation.
But
it needs to be mentioned.
It does need to be mentioned.
It does.
And I'm just going to be honest with our audience. And we have always talked about Melissa Witt, and we've talked about Morgan
Nick.
I knew
Melissa.
Those are the two cases that are very infamous around our area. And me and Patty had a long discussion that we don't really want to get our feet wet in either of those.
No, I try to stay away from those, but we get tips constantly.
Exactly. And every time we try to stay away from it, something comes back. But everything we just mentioned, it's all speculation.
Well,
but
part of it's speculation, part of it's not.
Yes.
The fact that he played pool, the fact that he had connections to Jenny Lind, the fact that he had been to the Campbell Cemetery, which was just right up the road from where her body was found, those are facts.
Those are facts.
That have to be considered. And when you talk about Charles Ray Vines, you have to include that.
Yes.
There's one other piece of information that Patty came up with that still we're working on and still has a very interesting part, and that is through some research online, she came up with Charles Ray Vines connected to an address 1805 South Z Street in Fort Smith. Now, people in Fort Smith who know this area very well will realize where that's located, but for the audience that may not be, it is in more or less south central Fort Smith up off of Jenny Lind, in an area south of an area called the Bailey Hill Reservoir. We have also talked about another case long unsolved here, Leslie Dawn Haig. And at the time of her death, she was living probably about a 3-minute car ride from this address at 1805 South Z. So in an attempt to see if we could connect him with additional information to that address, I went to one of our favorite sources, the R.L. Polk City Directory for Fort Smith. And in 1984, the resident at that address was a man named Rodney Bowers, who was identified as a reporter for the Southwest Times Record. Now, he later went on to work for the Arkansas Gazette and had a career in journalism. I was able to try and talk to him by phone, and unfortunately, when I called him, he was on vacation in Paris and wasn't really inclined to talk, but he said that he owned that house, later sold it, didn't know anything at all about anybody living there other than himself. If you dig back into the the R.L. Polk directories, you find other people who were associated with that dress, including Tom Black, who was at the time a locomotive engineer for Burlington Northern, and Eddie Black in 79, who may have been related to Tom Black, who was a house painter, and in 77, a woman named Irma Alexander. This is a fascinating thing that is hard to pin down, but if he were living there in 1985, it would be good information. And we know from looking through the Hague file that he was not interviewed, nor was that address canvassed, because it was outside the radius of the Hague street canvass that was done, which was very extensive canvassing done, trying to talk to every homeowner in the area of the Hague residence. And
one of the better canvasses that they have done in some of the stories and cases that we've witnessed so far.
And Tom and I were just talking before we started this podcast, and I'd like for Tom to repeat that about what the goal is when they do a canvas and how they most often do it.
Well, of course, you're looking for witnesses now, and you're looking for witnesses not necessarily to the actual event, but anything that was pertinent or relative on either side of it. And of course, we know from that case, she had left her home around 4:30 or 5 o'clock and walked down to Bailey Hill Reservoir. So that set the timeline, and detectives went out, you know, for several weeks and attempted to speak to every person at every home within the radius that they set out. If they didn't find anybody at the home, they came back. If they talked to someone at the home who said, I don't know anything, but you might want to talk to my husband when he gets off work, they'd go back. They actually heard from a number of people in the Bailey Hill neighborhood about a man that rode his bike through the area with a camera and was alleged to have tried to take pictures of young girls with or without their clothes. So the canvas brought them a lot of leads to check out. It just ultimately didn't lead either to resolution of that case or putting Charles Ray Vines in the neighborhood at the time.
And that year was what again?
1985.
So we've gone from.
Okay, so let's just do a little bit of a recap.
Yeah, we'll do a recap. Okay. So we've gone from 2000 yes. to 1985.
So in 1963, he was born.
Okay.
He was born. He has a couple of siblings. He had a mother and father. The father was very active in the business of caring for the deceased. So let's move forward. He went to school. He was arrested several times as a juvenile up into 1981. And in 1980, he was in the Harbor House for drug and alcohol addiction. It was court ordered. He spent a little time there. Then in 1983 or 1984, we find that he attended the Westark Community College, which is now the University of Arkansas, Fort Smith. So he was also arrested for shoplifting. In 1989, he had been married and had a couple of children and divorced. And then we don't really know a lot about him until 1990. And in 1990, sometime around the early 90s, he started coming to Van Buren. He had moved to Holt, Missouri. Now, there's a Holt City, Missouri, and there's a Holt County. We've been in touch with them. We also found out that he had a wife while he was up there and that we didn't know anything about. And I'm fixing to get to a story that you can share that I think may have some pertinence to that story. But he was married to an American Indian, and the only thing that the family remembers about her is that her first name was possibly Karen. Now, also one of the co-workers had met her twice when she came from Holt, Missouri, down to Ocker Funeral Home in Van Buren, where he was employed, and talked to them. And he remembers that she drove a blue van, that she was Indian, and he didn't remember her having a real outgoing personality. At the time, it appeared that she was upset with Charles Ray Vines about something. We don't know what that conversation was about.
So there's a period of time where he left the area, moved up to Missouri, mm-hmm. and then has moved back.
And while he was there, he did file bankruptcy, and Tom has pursued that lead. So,
yeah, part of what we tried to do is scour the public record for information on Charles Ray Vines, and I was pleasantly surprised when I found out that there was a bankruptcy case associated with him. It was filed in March 27, 1992. Technically, it was in the Western Missouri District, but that is Kansas City. It was associated with Holt, Missouri, and when we went looking for it, it was such an old case that it had been destroyed under federal records retention rules. It had been destroyed in 2016, I think, was when it was destroyed. So we don't know, you know, some of the basic things that you can get out of a bankruptcy filing or debts. You know, who did he owe money to? Oftentimes you list the members of the household. You would list your occupation, your income. Bankruptcy filings today provide, if they're done right, a lot of good household type information, because of course what that person is trying to do is ask the court to forgive their debts and let them be discharged. And he was discharged in July of 92, which was, you know, a fairly reasonable amount of time for a simple bankruptcy.
So he files for bankruptcy sometime around 1992 in Holt, Missouri. And then in 1993, there's the homicide victim, Juanita Wofford. And that was a brutal attack. Brutal. And he admitted that his favorite fantasy was necrophilia. So, which leads me on. He's already been married once. He's divorced. Now we understand that he had a wife in Holt, Missouri, by the first name, possibly Karen, who was an American Indian. We can't find any trace of her. We don't know what happened to her. But it reminded me of a story that you had told me years ago about a house in Fort Smith that
yes.
he had worked on.
Okay. And this goes with one of the cases that we do not want to wade into, and that would be the Morgan Nick case. I was working for a local radio station. I was doing their website, and they have those famous contests, and I know a lot of people are going to know.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Great station.
Yes, great station. Love them to death. But anyway, I get a phone call that says, hey, and it's the owner. He says, hey, I need you to go to this address. They're getting ready to do something, and I'm going to go on the air, and I'm going to talk about it. So I go up to the, I think it's the Rye Hill, White Bluff area.
And, south of Fort Smith.
Yeah, south.
Let's just go
deep,
with that.
Deep south Fort Smith. And so they've got a backhoe, and they're keeping all the press far enough back. I can see the backhoe. I can see them digging. And they're digging thinking that, you know, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, no, why are we digging here? Well, Charles Ray Vine did construction, and he did construction on that house.
So let me elaborate a little bit on that.
Yes.
For the audience. I have talked to the homeowner. She's been through a great deal in the last couple of years. I mean, I think the world of her. She's a great person. They built this beautiful home, and it was their dream home.
It's a really nice house.
Yeah, I'm sure, because she's a very classy lady. And Charles Ray Vines was doing some French drains as groundwork before the home started. So these are drains underneath the construction.
Yes.
She begins getting sick from smells. I believe she was even hospitalized from those smells. And so she had a concern. And then when all this came to light, then it prompted what you're fixing, you know, what
yes.
you're telling about.
So they had the officers out there. They had the backhoe, and they were digging. And they had cadaver dogs. The cadaver dogs hit, and they said, well, we got to dig deeper. Well, they dug a little deeper. Cadaver dog hit again, so they dug a little deeper. And that was the last time they could dig, because then they were unsure that the foundation was going to be affected. So they had to stop the dig, although the cadaver dog still made a hit after that last dig. And they were thinking that Charles Ray Vines may have had something to do with the Morgan Nick case. And they never did find anything, but the cadaver dog on the last hit, as I was there, they said made a hit, but they couldn't dig any further because it would damage the foundation.
I think that anybody that came on the radar also became a suspect in the Morgan Nick case. Yes, I mean, just automatically.
Exactly. I mean, during that whole thing, and they're still looking, and there's a lot of viable leads.
I think what came down to on that one is it was such an expensive, a costly home.
Yes.
They didn't want to do damages and be responsible. They have a limited budget. I understand that.
It was going to cost, I mean, a lot. If that foundation went where they were digging, you're going to have to rebuild half the house
to remain anonymous. And I will respect that because I do think a lot of her.
But I was there when they were digging, and I do know the last thing that they said is that the dogs made another hit, but we could not dig any further.
I have heard the same thing. So he comes back from Holt, Missouri, and he tells someone that he's working closely with that the heat got really hot in Missouri and he had to leave. And this person believes that he did leave abruptly because he came down with just a few things and showed up at the door where they worked and just wanted to get to work. And so his job at that time was to help move and set tombstones. Now, at the time, this business was located where the Arvest Bank branch is on M Highway in Van Buren. They've since moved since then. But at that time, that's what he was tasked with, was setting headstones. He may have also assisted in some carving of stones, that type of stuff. But that's what he did. He also still had contact with the woman in Missouri. And then the homeowner that you were talking about.
Yes, this was back in early 2000s when this dig.
She also says that there was a man who was working with him that lived in Locust Grove that said that Charles had spent the weekend with him. And that at one night he had brought this woman he described as an American Indian to his house. This man went to bed. He said that he thought they were just having really rough sex all night. There was a lot of noise. When he got up the next morning, his house had a lot of blood in it. He never saw the woman again. That's why it's so important for us to find out if we can locate this Karen.
Exactly. And I mentioned, the Morgan Nick case. Do I believe Morgan Nick anything to do with him? Right now, I would say no.
Okay.
So that's my opinion.
Let's go back a little bit in 1994. In 1994 is when he began building the cabin in Dripping Springs, Arkansas.
Right.
The infamous cabin. And Tom and I have done a lot of research on that area. We've talked to some people from that area. But in 1994, so what I said a while ago is that he kind of sticks to a territory or an area that he feels comfortable in. In 1994, Door Doe is dumped on 64D in Door, Oklahoma, just right across the state line.
So basically we have a body.
There's no proof
dumped.
That he did Door Doe, but he matches the description. The car description and the partial tag all match one that he had access to. So the witnesses that actually saw a man, what they believe was dumping the bags that her body was contained in, gave a pretty good description.
Right.
However, they believe that she had been dead for several months, if not months. So keep that in mind. But in 1994, after the incidents that all happened along Jenny Lind Avenue in Fort Smith, Arkansas, then he moves to and starts building the cabin in 1994. 1994 is the same year that Dora Doe is found, and it's the year that Melissa turns up missing, December 1st, 1994. So he is also, shortly after that, married to another woman. And that marriage lasts, what, Tom, 3 months?
Very briefly, yeah. That was 1997.
Yeah. And we did talk to her son and daughter-in-law, and she has since passed away. He didn't really want to elaborate much on that marriage. He said she realized pretty fast it was a mistake. She was from Mount Ida. So we don't know how they met, but we do know that Charles liked to spend a lot of time in that area at a recreation area camping. He was big hunter, camper.
Yeah, he liked the outdoors. And if you've noticed in your timeline, and we've discussed this, his area has gotten a little bit bigger.
Well, it moved from the Jenny Lind area.
Yeah, moved from Jenny Lind.
Now to up in Dripping Springs, which is north of Van Buren, Arkansas,
right.
Up on 59 Highway, kind of out in the. And what's interesting is, if I've talked to people that were close to him, they said he often would talk about how you could get by with a crime in a cemetery, how you could go to a country cemetery, and if it had a slope, you could cover up the grave, and you could hide evidence, you could dig up dig up a grave, whatever. Nobody would be the wiser. Do you know what, when he got his cabin completed, there's a deck. Do you know what's directly across the street from there?
I'm going to say a cemetery,
possibly. A cemetery.
Yeah.
A cemetery. Yes.
He's a weird cat.
I can't imagine being married to a man that also likes to sleep with dead people.
That's.
I'm glad you can't imagine that.
I can't imagine it.
I'm glad you can't.
I wonder how much you'd have to take awful lot of drugs and alcohol to get to that point.
I don't know. At that I've never time, taken drugs.
Well,
maybe.
Me neither.
Maybe it's a good reason I didn't.
But, I mean, you had Jeffrey Dahmer, and he said he was up to, I don't know how many, 30, two or four, no, he said it was three or four cases of beer when he would go and do the awful things that he did. So can you imagine what Charles Ray was having
to do? He drank
all
the time.
Yeah.
All the time. I mean, he really did.
A fifth of whiskey a day is what what he admitted to.
That's a lot, right?
That's a lot.
Well, it would be for me.
I mean, that'd last me
a
decade.
Another thing that we found out during the course of this is that he was selling leather goods. He would go out on the road and sell leather goods. And he was known to travel in the Kansas City area to sell leather goods. I don't want to even know where these leather goods came from, but they were handmade leather goods. Anybody?
All right.
Well, anybody want to chime in on that one, or just leave it alone?
We're going to leave that one alone.
Tom, I see you taking a breath.
Well, what I was going to say about, we would really like to interview anyone who was involved in an intimate relationship with Charles Ray Vines. I mean, you have to think that they knew what was happening in his life if they lived with him. But our the indications that we have is he was married to at least three people.
At least.
We have a couple of other names that were supplied to us that we still can't track down. I mean, we've checked the obvious sources in Crawford County and Sebastian County, which is where we found, the marriage from 1997. But it's difficult to verify marriages since they're issued on a county basis, and he moved around.
Well, I want to mention something else that I think is interesting. On the third marriage that only lasted 3 months, he was in his 30s. She was in her 50s. It didn't last long. But he always said, and he said this in an interview, that he liked older women and necrophilia. So there could be a reason it only lasted 3 months.
With that, we're going to leave on that note, and then we'll do the upcoming podcast, the next podcast on Charles Ray Vines. So we've gone, I'll just do a little recap. We've tracked backwards from 2000 all the way back to 1985 on Charles Ray Vines and his doing. So real quick, we'll go. 2000 was when he got caught with the 16-year-old.
Yes.
And then he admitted to the
Mrs. Wofford and Mrs. Henderson,
the two
one
older
in
ladies,
Smith and one in Crawford County.
In Crawford County, and that was in the 90s, early
90s. That was in 93 and 94, I believe.
93 and 94, and then
had DNA, and
right.
He knew that.
Yep.
Now, there's another thing I want to share real quick.
Okay.
He did at one time send me a letter that one of the ex-prosecuting attorneys says is the closest he's ever come to admitting to being involved in Door Dog.
And we'll get to that later.
We're going to do that next time?
We're going to do that on the next podcast. So we've gone from 2000 to 1985. And
we have a lot more. A
lot more to come. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us on the internet at www.rememberEveryVictim.com and also check us out on our Facebook page, which is Revamp, rememberEveryVictim.com.
And also, if anybody is interested in joining the team at Revamp, we have an application that's available. You can download that application. It goes straight to our team coordinator, who's a pretty straight-up guy.
Yeah, so, Mr. Tom Honeycutt.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So, if you are really into cold cases and, crimes interest you and you think you would be good at digging up dirt on people, give us a call.
Absolutely. And what is our motto at Revamp?
well, we will always remember our victims.
And we will not forget.
We will not forget.